issue.
Afternoon. I'm going to open the hearing on for the Joint Committee on Natural Resources, Subcommittee on Natural Resources for the Ways and Means Committee on today, and today is February 28th. Oh, I have 27th down here. we're going to continue our presentation regarding the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And do you have anything that you need to introduce?
No, Co-Chair Frederick, I don't have any comments this morning other than we are beginning on the agency's presentation document, page 28. Thank you.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and take off there. Your mic is somewhere. There's a second one there. Oh, there we go. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. For the record, Jim Rue, Director, and Carrie McLaren, Deputy Director. So we're going to try to, well, we are going to make this shorter today because Kathy Connolly from the Chief Financial Office has a short presentation, but I'm hoping we can get our part wrapped up in an hour, and we're going to do everything we can to do that. So with that, Carrie is going to start on key performance measures.
Thank you, Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie McLaren, Deputy Director for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Beginning on slide 29, sort of more substantively, that lays out the approved key performance measures for our agency. I'm going to go through them in some detail, lumped thematically in terms of the areas that they cover. But first, what I'd like to do is, at a very high level, give you an overview of where we see ourselves sitting relative to our key performance measures. That is one that we have mixed results. 8 of our 12 measures met or exceeded the targets. We've seen some increases and some decreases in this past biennium. Most of the results that we measure in our key performance measures, and this may have come up in other contexts, are actions that are actually taken at the city or county level. And in that sense, we're an indirect actor or an indirect participant in some of the measures. Nonetheless, they do represent desired outcomes of the state's land use planning program, and so it's understandable why that tension or potential disconnect is there. The challenges are ones that we talked about a little bit yesterday in terms of increasing our performance is really around limited and state resources, including grant availability and just the capacity overall for a staff of, fewer than 60 FTE to really provide the level of ongoing technical assistance that we find so productive for local government partnerships. We have requested a change for the 2017 to 2019 biennium with respect to 3 KPMs. The first 2 that we're requesting changes for, and I want to maybe clarify what we started saying yesterday. Let me do a little bit better job of setting this up. We think of changes to our key performance measures in 2 ways and in 2 time periods. The first one, we have 3 very minor proposes to change for this biennium. What we were alluding to yesterday is sort of a preview that as we begin to work more on our performance management system internally, we expect that that should yield more meaningful performance measures for us to bring to the legislature and to suggest either as additions or replacements. We're not there yet. We just wanted to give maybe a preview to that potential later action. To focus on the 2 that we propose to change, they are really with KPM number 7 and number 8. They relate to our farm and forest land measures. This is a very technical change and therefore challenging to describe. What that key performance measure does is say how much of our farm and forest land have we retained, protected, kept in productive agricultural and forest use as compared to the 1987 sort of point in time. What we have done historically is to say we took an average of between 1989 and 2003 and said how much farmland and how much forest land did we lose in those periods, and we assumed that that would happen going forward. We're proposing that instead of having a static time frame for the average farmland loss, that we extend that to current. And the reason why is somewhat important in that we will begin to use, as our cities expand and use up lands that are already impacted by development, we do expect that we will begin losing more farmland to urban growth. And we do expect we will probably lose more forest land to urban growth. And we think our performance targets should be set with that reasonable expectation in mind. This is not a big change. When we went and ran the numbers, I think it's less than a tenth of a percent change overall right now to the target. So modest, but the kind of improvement that we do think makes our key performance measures and targets more meaningful to you. The third proposal change that we're making is with respect to certified industrial sites. That is a key performance measure that says how many sites were certified as shovel-ready industrial. That program is run by the Oregon Business and Development Department, or Business Oregon. They're recommending some changes. We're tagging on to their proposal. If it changes for them, it ought be correlated for us. So with those mechanics aside, I'm going to go more quickly through where we are in terms of our performance measures.
Just a second.
Yes.
You indicated deleting number four, and
yes.
Then, but you just said that you were talking about an adjustment. Am I missing something here?
I may have spoken too quickly. So for the record, I will correct. We are proposing to delete that measure, consistent with Business Oregon's proposal.
Business Oregon is basically saying that they're not going to give you a list of the number of sites project ready. Is that?
Co-chair Frederick, members of the committee, the Certified Industrial Site Program is being retooled by Business Oregon right now, and as they are both revamping and I think trying to reinvigorate that program, they will be identifying a different target to be measured against. We want to make sure. Well, they will be doing that for themselves. Until they do so, there's no target for us to try to meet.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for slowing me down to walk through that. So again, at a high level, on the urban development side, we look at how much land do we have available for employment, how much land of that is serviced by urban facilities and transit. And in this area, we are doing quite well. I'm sorry, I got ahead of myself. I apologize. With respect to employment land supply, this measures how many cities have an adequate, or is intended to measure how many cities have an adequate supply of industrial employment land. The difficulty here in the measure, as I indicated at the outset, is that these actions, economic opportunities analyses, are actions that are taken by local governments, often funded with our technical assistant grant funds, but not always, sometimes undertaken by cities on their own. We are seeing a trend downward that is disappointing. We have a target of 75% of our cities have updated economic opportunities analyses, which means that they've done that work in the last 10 years. Only 28% of our cities meet that standard. On the flip side, what I would say is that we do see cities being able to use these economic opportunities analyses over time to replenish their industrial and employment land sites. So we have seen a number of cities undertake that planning. The city of Prineville is an example we often call out because of what they've been doing with their lands for server farms in that area. I would also note that this measurement is tied to who has to undertake periodic review, which cities are required to update their plans every 10 years. And over time, the legislature has changed that standard to applying only to cities over 10,000. And yet, as a department, we do still prioritize work with our smaller communities. So, for example, this last biennium, we gave grants for economic opportunities analyses to Lincoln City, to Talent, to Newburgh, to North Plains, and to Sweet Home, even though those cities are under 10,000. And we just believe that work is important, even though it might not be reflected in our key performance measures. A similar story in terms of how we interact with housing supply. So again, that is a local government doing a housing needs analysis and then expanding their urban growth boundary if they're shown to have a deficit of land. Here, perhaps coming out of the recession with all the discussions about affordable housing, we really are seeing cities invest in updating their housing needs analyses, and our actual performance is about 80%. Our target is 90%, so we're still not quite meeting it, but we're coming a lot closer, and we have funded a number of those housing needs analyses and provided technical assistance. Key performance measure, these three key KPMs report reflect public facilities and services. It's very critical, I alluded to yesterday, that it's one thing to have an urban growth boundary that has enough land, but how do we actually get that land into a development-ready state? We need to have sewer, water, transit, other public infrastructure to those. Our target in this area is that 70% of our cities will have updated public facilities plans. We are exceeding that target right now, which I think shows an improved performance both on the part of the state and in terms of local governments really trying to bring land into a development-ready state. Likewise, we exceed targets in our areas for cities adopting transit-supported land use, so codes that actually work together with transit to prioritize higher density development along transit corridors, and also cities updating their transportation facilities plans to assure that they have a roadmap, so to speak, for their transportation infrastructure. In all those areas, we are meeting or exceeding our targets. Farmland and forest land protection, KPM 7 and 8, continue to be, I think, a source of success relative to the targets that are set for the agency. So again, here, our targets are that we will have 99.95% of the EFU-zoned property that we had in 1987. We are just almost meeting that target, and same on the forest land side. This is an area of interest, and we will be watching as we see cities expand more into areas that are more heavily surrounded by productive farm and forest lands. Which brings me to number eight is about urban growth boundary expansions. And this is an interesting target for us to have. The measurement is how much land that was added to urban growth boundaries is farm or forest land. And I would offer to this committee that whether or not we can meet that target is highly situational. So in the last reporting period that's before you right now, 92% of our urban growth boundary expansions occurred on land that was not zoned for commercial farm or forest use. So in that sense, we were very successful in prioritizing land that was already not as productive for those uses to be brought into our cities, already development impacted. However, one of those cities was Grants Pass, and Grants Pass had a large amount of land around it that had in the 70s been somewhat built up and developed, and therefore was not being used as much for commercial agriculture. The next time around we show you our KPMs, they will include in part the city of Woodburn, which is surrounded entirely almost by Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 farmland. So our numbers will likely be different because of where our cities are located and the lands that surround them. The final area of key performance measure that I will touch upon really measures our internal business practices. And the one that I would highlight here, we've talked quite a bit about grants, but is in the area of customer satisfaction. And I highlight this in part because of the discussion Director Rue had with you yesterday about our commitment and depth of commitment of working individually with cities, serving on technical advisory committees, providing as much advanced technical assistance during planning processes as we can. I'm pleased to report that we had an uptick significantly in our overall response rate in our survey, telling us that more people were interested in actually responding. We had a 15% overall increase in how customers are satisfied with the work that we provide to them. Particular areas of note that I would call out for the committee on the areas of expertise of our respondents, 96% indicated that we had that they had a high level of regard for our expertise in the field. We were timely at 90%. We were accurate at 88%. That requires real work of being in the field with our staff, but I think it yields real results in the end for the planning program as well. And with that, I will turn it over to Director Rue to talk about changes in the last 6 years.
Thank you. Thank you. We've talked about some of these, and I'm going to go through them pretty quickly just in the interest of time. But starting on the right and working left, starting in 2011, one of the projects that we spent a lot of time on was a climate adaptation framework. And just to state the obvious, there are two responses to climate. One is to try to mitigate climate causing emissions. The other is to adapt to a changing climate. And we spent our time on the latter with all of the agencies in the natural resource world. And we worked for about a year to come up with some responses. And among them, probably the most obvious, was vulnerable populations in larger cities having to respond to increased heat. So we have been trying to share some of that, particularly with the city of Portland and other places where we find people at risk. But we also found that the danger of catastrophic flood, the danger of catastrophic storms increasing over time. It's always tempting to try to mix weather and climate, but I think we can probably all attest to the fact that we have, in fact, seen increases in large and potentially catastrophic storms over the last 10 or 20 years, probably since the middle 90s, to be sure. Agricultural soils assessments, we talked a little bit yesterday about soil testing and rural residential. This was basically just a brokerage that the agency served. If an individual wanted to get a soil reclassification, they would come to us. We would match them up with a certified soil tester. Kerry has talked a fair bit about our information management initiative. It started nearly 6 years ago. And we've wrapped it up. There's a lot more work to be done, but obviously it's something that we keep picking away at all the time. Oregon Sustainable Transportation Initiative. In 07, the legislature passed targets for greenhouse gas reduction for the entire state. We, working with ODOT, took on this business of voluntarily, for the most part, asking communities to think about how to reduce the use of single occupancy vehicles. When I say most part, the only part of the state that was required to submit a plan and actually begin to reduce is Portland Metro. Everybody else is doing it voluntarily. And we talked a little bit about metro urban rural reserves. It was a very long time ago. We're hoping to wrap that up sometime this spring with Clackamas County in the process right now of acknowledging their reserves. We talked briefly, jumping to 1315, we talked briefly about non-point source pollution in the coastal zone. I'm not going to go over that. One of the really big projects that we worked on in 1315 and for several years running up to that was a dynamic map of the territorial sea, all 3 miles out, all 0 to 600 feet deep. And it was a use GIS layers-based map. So everything from cables and ground fisheries to fisheries in the column, to every conceivable use, we had over 100 layers of uses of the territorial sea. It was used primarily to help us prepare for Ocean Energy, not much of that has developed, as we talked about yesterday, but it's still a very useful tool for people proposing projects in the coastal zone. We talked about UGB streamlining. Economic Recovery Review Council, I think it actually predated 13. In response to the recession in 8-9, I think it was probably in the, well, it was either the 9 or the 11 session, working with Business Oregon, we came up with a rapid response to identifying areas around the state where once we had a completed application, we would guarantee a 120-day turnaround for all permits if companies were seeking to site in these particular areas. Measure 49 transfer of development credits. For those people who had Measure 49 allowances who maybe weren't interested in building themselves, and we were giving them an opportunity to essentially trade the value of that development right for something closer to a city. And it might, in fact, increase their return a little bit. We haven't seen an awful lot of activity with that. Carrie talked about jumping now to 15-17 customer satisfaction survey. I'm not going to spend another moment on that because she's already talked about it. From the legislature a year ago, got a pilot project that related to expanding the urban growth boundary for affordable housing. We had until July of 17 to get the rules done. We got them done in January of this year. And so we're now out soliciting one community of greater than 25,000 people and one community of fewer than 25,000 people to test the proposition. National flood insurance, we talked a little bit about yesterday. I'll skip over it. We also talked about lack of federal revenue due to non-point source controls. Sage-grouse continues to move forward. We have set up a registry that identifies all of the developable land in the seven counties that we talked about yesterday, and we're working very closely with the business development folks to make sure that there is in fact business going into those areas. And the last one was simply updating the transportation initiative from 5 years before. So what are we doing? Can we move ahead to improving program delivery? I'm going to pick and choose on these because I want to get through this pretty quickly. Grant funding for population forecasting. We talked about that a little bit yesterday. Population forecasts are the antecedent to everything that follows with UGB expansions. Communities used to have to pay for these population forecasts themselves. Starting in probably 12, DLCD began work with the Population Research Center at Portland State. We now pay them something just south of $500,000 a year to do population forecasts, for the entire state. A quarter of the state done each year. So it's $500,000 a biennium, I probably said year, to do. So it's about $250,000 per year to do population forecasting for a quarter of the state. One of the things I think that has translated to a bump up in our customer satisfaction is that we now do online training for planning commissions, electeds. We've supplemented that with planners network meetings on a quarterly basis at a quarter of the state. We go four times a year to a different part of the state, working with people directly to help them understand how to proceed with the system. I'm going to skip through the rest of that one. In 1315, we actually adopted by rule the territorial sea plan. We've talked about UGB streamlining. We've talked about IMI. We have an intranet site so that we're spending less time on email and more collaborative work within the agency on the intranet. We have been working with the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State to come up with a single land use portal in their Oregon Explorer. We had a new tsunami land use guide, which we continue to refine to help coastal communities prepare for the inevitable. The mediation issue there is we talked a little bit yesterday about Woodburn and solving the Woodburn UGB. And I mentioned that we had hired a former Oregon State Supreme Court Justice to serve as a mediator. We kind of like this idea of mediation, of people who are disputants to an issue sitting down around the table and solving it for themselves. Things that end up going to the Court of Appeals often take 2+ years to resolve. We did this one in about 4 months. And so it's something that we'll be likely using more of in the future. And I think I'm going to stop because you get the idea. Excuse me. So moving on to the budget, let's just go directly. A couple of things that I'd like to point out here. So you see that we had a pretty good bump between 1315 and 1517, roughly $1.5 million of increases. Most of that, well, a third of it, went to our population forecasting at PSU. Another big chunk of it went to our Southern Oregon Regional Pilot Project, it's not Senator Esquivel anymore, is it? Representative
Esquivel.
I'm a
recovering senator.
There were some funding issues with the Columbia River Gorge counties a couple of years ago, and so there was an additional bump of funding to them. That drops down by about $600,000, just slightly more than $600,000 in general fund, as you can see, for the upcoming biennium. And most of that is due to the fact that SORP and the Gorge Commission expenses were one-time expenses, and so that brings us back down to a number that's just under $13 million. And I'm really not going to spend any more time because the other fund and the federal funds are sort of bouncing around. There are a couple of bumps due to the fact that we're getting more money from FEMA to do floodplain mapping and management. And we're the ones who do the GIS maps that delineate those floodplains.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. I was just curious. Hi, sorry. What percentage of the total funds here that you have is spent on approximately on FTE? I'm just trying to get a sense of where the dollars go in your agency.
Thank you, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Senator Taylor. 70%?
Oh, that low, okay.
It's probably, Teddy, 70-75%. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably pretty standard across mm-hmm. the enterprise, is that close to 3/4 of what we spend is on people. And supplies and services gets us up into the probably low 80s, and so everything else we do is less than 20.
Okay, follow up?
Sure.
What's your second biggest cost then after personnel?
Supplies and services, probably.
Hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yep. Okay, some budget challenges. Next one. Again, there's not a lot new here. Obviously, we're 2/3 or so funded general fund. And just to state it bluntly, if it's a kid in a classroom or an extra grant to a local community, the kid wins. And so for the most part, when we're in budget crunches, we find that our cuts are pretty significant. And as you know, in the governor's recommended budget, it's about 7.5% reduction for our agency. The other two largely due to whatever happens with the federal budget. So just some charts. This just lays it out, I think, graphically pretty well. The blue is our general fund. The purple or whatever it is our federal fund. And the orange is the other funds. Primarily for other funds, it is the money that comes to us from ODOT for our transportation and growth management program. This one basically gives you an idea, as you can see on the subhead, general fund grant history. So if you go back nearly 20 years, you can see that in, I guess it was 99-2001, our general fund grants were really close to $3 million. And over here on the 15-17 budget, that gray wedge is for population forecasting. So our general fund grants today are a little more than a third of what they were 20 years ago. The proposition that we believe in deeply is that if local governments can't plan, this system doesn't work, plain and simple. And so if they don't have money to do their planning work, things start getting a little rocky when it comes to preparing for jobs and housing for a 20-year planning horizon. Because as we said yesterday, and this is the point that I was trying to make, planning happens in local governments. We give some money and we give some technical assistance, but we don't do much actual planning in Salem. And beyond that, you can take a look at some of the slices and what has happened, but I think the overall notion is that periodic review, technical assistance, are a fraction of what they were in the past. This one, do we have the table, Harry, or do we get?
Just in our notes, okay. We just need to walk.
So what this says is, again, blue is periodic review requests. The greenish yellow is technical assistance requests. And the lines, the dark blue line, is what we actually funded for periodic review. And then I guess it's a dark green line, is what we actually funded for technical assistance. The only point of this is that our requests are on the order of 2+ times the amount of money that we have to spend. And we think those are credible requests because we go through a competitive process. Local government submits a request to fund, excuse me, and we're able to meet about a third of those. This graph sort of goes back to what we talked about yesterday a little bit, and when I asked you to think about why we plan. People continue to come to Oregon. That's the graph on the left side. People who come to Oregon continue to need jobs. That's the graph on the right side. Going back to the 1980s, you can see that in the early 80s, it was the only time in Oregon's recent history when we've had net out migration. For what, 14, 15 of the years, or I'm sorry, let's say 7 of the years in the last 37 have been an anomaly, otherwise a growing state. Net in-migration is the dark blue, so-called natural increase. The net of births and deaths is the light blue. The red is the growth rate. So you can see you can see the recessions, the 1980s recession, the so-called dot-com bubble in 2001, and then in 8 and 9. Jumping over to the other one, you can see that Portland at the top lost about 8% of its jobs during the recession. But Portland has come roaring back, as we all know, regularly in the top five in the country in terms of job growth. So 9.1% job growth since the recession. Columbia River Gorge, the Dalles and Hood River are likewise growing rapidly. Central Oregon has not, particularly Bend, Redmond, has not gotten back or has not recovered all of the losses. They have, in fact, recovered the losses, but their growth rate is slower than the rest of the metro area. The thing to point out here is that the South Coast and southeastern Oregon haven't come close to recovering from the recession, and we talked about that a little bit yesterday in terms of where we want to be spending some of our time and energy in the upcoming biennium is helping to alleviate and accelerate some of that job growth, particularly in those two parts of the state. Just another graph to point out the obvious. Poverty levels, Josephine County, Malheur County, Crook, Wheeler County, still very high. One thing I would point out is that Malheur now, in terms of unemployment, is coming back a little bit, and that means Harney is the only one that is really stuck in the red. So we might be able to infer from that jobs are coming back to Malheur County, but we still haven't broken out of that cycle of poverty. And that's exactly what we're hoping to address with some targeted measures, again, that we talked about a little bit yesterday. And I'm kind of roaring through this stuff so that we can give Kathy time and you all time for questions. Maybe Rep. Helm has one now.
Can you go back to your previous slide?
Yes.
Do we also have an overlay that would be of the amount of unused industrially zoned land by county or by city?
Carrie.
Thank you, co-chairs.
That might correspond here.
Unfortunately, no. So one of the areas, and I will actually give credit to a staff member that we recently lost in the department, who, spent a considerable amount of time working with local governments trying to get them to digitize and update their plans so that we would be able to begin to have updatable and replicable buildable land inventory. So it's a challenge for local governments to keep up. They need to go out and inventory, and it's hard to tell what is being utilized, what's being underutilized, what's available for redevelopment, having made those calls to track the development then that goes on over time. I do think it'd be a good investment for the state, but again, it depends upon that local capacity. We try to help where we can in getting some of those communities into the GIS and online, age, but it is a work in progress. Another area that I might point the committee to is some work that should be wrapping up in the next year, looking more specifically at rural industrial lands that are outside of urban growth boundaries that were former mill sites, and trying to examine whether or not those would be a good palette for some economic development. In many cases, if they were mill sites, depending upon the kind of mill, they might have the infrastructure, whether it's rail or other transportation or water or sewer services, that really are critical, a critical investment, and might be a good place for us to be targeting economic development and growth. So in part, we recognize the need, but no, there is not a statewide inventory that allows us to assess that.
If I may add to that, some of you perhaps know that the state's geospatial enterprise office, so-called GEO, physically relocated to DLCD just over a year ago so that and they're still organizationally part of DAS, but they live and work with our GIS people, our mapping people now, to try to get some advantages for each and both by working together. The Geospatial Enterprise Office has been working with the Joint Committee on Tech to come up with a bill, which has now been introduced, that would in fact share data between local governments and the state in an attempt to get at some of this without lots of cost to cash-strapped local governments.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I love that idea. I love that idea because what it ends up revealing, I think, is something that anecdotally we know to be true, which is that we do have consistent challenges in the rural parts of our state with economic development. The argument ends up being over whether that, what's the source of that. And I personally feel that there's a disconnect between the idea that land use planning laws are restricting economic development in those areas and the fact that there is unused industrial land that's ready for development and has been ready for development for decades. And the real problem is the cost of providing infrastructure to those lands and getting them economically viable and ready for the type of development that I think we all want to have there. And unveiling that disconnect would be tremendously valuable to the legislature.
Thank you. So again, yesterday we talked a
little bit. Can you hold on just a second?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That brings up a couple of issues I remember here in our Medford area. We had a store that bought a piece of property that was zoned for that property, and they took them 8.5 years to get a building permit. Time's money. The other one was at CoGap Manufacturing. You may be familiar with that project. 9.5 years in the making. Wow, you know. It's pretty slow.
Well,
I'm curious on one thing before you get started. How do you get a town like on a Vale to do an urban growth boundary when they're surrounded by crops?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel. We actually spent a bunch of time in Vale, Nyssa, and Ontario two summers ago and got somewhere around 300 acres added in Vail, about the same in Nyssa, and about 500 acres in Ontario. In each case, it was farmland today because that land, that industrial land, has not yet been sold to a developer and does not have employment land development on it. It is still being farmed. But when title changes, when somebody comes along and wants to start a business there or expand a business there, that land will then convert. But today it is still ag land.
If you don't mind, I want to go back to something. I just want to echo something that I keep running into. The community, the voters and others believe that you are already talking to one another via technology, that we already have that information and that we're already doing that. When they hear that this is new, it's a little disconcerting. So we've got to recognize that that's what people believe we're already doing.
Co-Chair Frederick, you're absolutely right. But the issue as we see it is largely the gap between metropolitan areas and more rural parts of the state. So in communities where there is capacity, people and money and technology, it is already happening. But in places like Harney County and Lake County and Klamath County and some others around the state, candidly, in Lake County, their planning department is one guy and a part-time support person. Ditto in Harney County. they simply don't have the time, money, or expertise to be able to do this on their own.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Medford, when I was on the city council, we were doing GIS overlays with infrastructure, water, street drains, the storm drains, everything. We had that all compacted at that time, and I'm surprised that we, if we do anything wrong in the state, it's, we don't seem to keep up with technology as rapidly as everyone else does for some reason.
Well, I agree with you, but it's also a matter of, as you said, Harney County, their priorities. Mm-hmm. What do they prioritize? What do they have available to them? And you've got to figure out what you want to do first. And that's part of what takes place in Harney County and Lake County. They've decided that they want to spend the money and the time on a number of other issues, and that's what they run into. So,
not the least of which being public safety.
Right. Right.
So exactly. as you know, Josephine County doesn't even have full time county sheriff capacity.
I think they have one or two.
Who work nearly full time, not being able to cover 24 hours in a day. Okay, moving on quickly. Again, I talked about this yesterday, but this is a project that we've been working on with the Regional Solutions Center in Portland, identifying this pocket of poverty. So again, the blue area, East Portland and East County, Multnomah County, a very persistent pocket of poverty. And as you can see, not yet majority, but very close to majority people of color. And so one of the very hopeful things, and Bobby Lee, who is the coordinator for the Metro Regional Solutions team, has been working with the Port of Portland and others, and many of you probably saw that Amazon is committed to building a distribution center there. A couple of thousand really good jobs, but not just Amazon, because what we see in other Amazon distribution areas around the country is that Amazon, as you probably know, doesn't distribute just their stuff, but they work as a fulfillment and distribution center for other companies. And so where Amazon locates, you find other smaller companies putting their distribution centers there as well. So we're hoping that this is going to be a real spur to jobs in this very seriously underserved part of the state.
Let me break in there, because you a portion of that map, the area west of 205, the northern area west of 205 is my district, and the other areas east of 205 is what's known as the, in many of the black communities, known as the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Because folks have been gentrified out of the other section. Mm-hmm. And moved over into that area. So that's, I'm seeing this daily in my district. So this is going to be, to have any new infrastructure and to have new companies and businesses within the manufacturing or whatever, is going to be a big boon to that area. It's going to be very important. In the same way, we see what's going on in eastern Oregon, the Hermiston area as well, and some of those areas desperately need that kind of support as well. So it's going to be interesting to watch this develop.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Frederick. One of the tasks that the Regional Solutions team is taking on right now is making sure that the transportation networks are in place. So working closely with TriMet to make sure that people have a way from getting from their homes to these jobs. We really want to finish up by 2 o'clock. So, okay, all right, Kathy. One of the other reasons that we plan is for natural hazards. And so we just wanted to take a look at how the map lays out for a variety of hazards. And this is kind of the big four. The ones that we work with very closely are particularly earthquake and the resultant tsunami, landslide, and flood. But we also work very closely with the Department of Forestry and others on the wildfire issue. We have talked a little bit about the Bend UGB. One of the real victories in this last round of urban growth boundary expansion in Bend was a voluntary agreement between landowners, environmental organization, and frankly the Forest Service, to try to keep development away from the west side of Bend, which is immediately butting up against national forest land. Obviously, the primary reason for staying out of that urban wildland interface is because of fire danger physically to people. But I think you also probably are all aware of the fact that fighting a fire, a residential fire, a house fire, in that interface is 2 to 3 times as expensive as fighting the same fire in open forest land. And Peter Daugherty, if he hasn't been in front of you, we will be soon, and he'll be talking about the extraordinary costs of fighting fire in the last 10 years. And he's had a break. He and Doug Decker have had a break, obviously. We've all had a break in the last couple of seasons. But it's huge that we pay a lot of attention to how people and where people live along that interface. Okay. I just want to quickly run down this list because these are places where we will be focusing some energy. So our grants under the governor's recommended budget will go almost exclusively to that purple zone that you saw on the prior map. The governor's budget has taken all of our discretionary planning grant money and focused it for the upcoming biennium on tsunami resilience in the coastal zone. And that will be work to help communities think about where they build, how they build, how citizens get out of those communities. You know, we hear that once the shaking is over, there's 20 minutes before the tsunami arrives. And so it's critical that people know exactly how to get to high land and do it quickly. Occasionally they're going to have to find refuge in place. There will be opportunities to do some thinking about what that looks like. But making sure that people are safe all up and down the coast is going to be where an awful lot of this money goes. Natural hazards, again. Urban growth boundary streamlining of the affordable housing project. We're hoping that we'll get a couple of candidate communities in the next couple of months and we can really start to test the proposition. Information, we've all said it. It is one of those areas where we tend to lag and we're trying to close that gap. Sage-grouse, we talked about. One of the things that we now do is we don't travel so much anymore because we have a teleconferencing program called Zoom, and we use it every day, multiple times a day. So when we used to just get people in their cars to drive over to Salem for a meeting, or conversely, we'd head for Bend or something else, we now just pull it up on Zoom. The picture and audio quality is really good. We took an old library and repurposed it. So for somewhere around $8,000 or $10,000, we have a fully functional teleconferencing capacity, and I'm sure we saved those $8,000 or $10,000 easily in the first year. And it's just something that we now use almost without thinking. Um,
You know, as we have less money for local grants, our work with the regional solutions team just becomes excuse me, that much more critical. I'm a huge fan of regional solutions, not the least of which reasons for which is that we co-locate with four other agencies. People sit in several of those regional solution centers around a center table, and that's where they do their work. They have little cubbies and little cubicles, but an awful lot of the work is done around the table, solving economic development problems in the local community. And what else do we have? We must be getting close to the end.
We are.
Why don't we go ahead and just talk, Carrie, about the budget, and then we'll be done.
So I'll flip through to the beginning part of the budget in terms of some of the adjustments. As Director Rue indicated, and as you've seen in our budget materials, the governor's recommended budget is a 7% reduction to our current service level. That amounts in for the department of a loss of three positions, all of which are planning positions, two specialists and one field representative. So staff, which are out there providing that technical assistance for local governments, but we don't have a lot of other areas that we are able to do cuts in. We have also held vacancy savings, reduced our attorney general budget, office supplies and services, those sorts of things where we have more discretionary funding, really driven them low so that we can try to retain as much staff capacity and grant funding capacity as possible. The second policy adjustment does go to reflects changes in state charges, so just really a flow through to us for Attorney General and state service charges. I think probably more meaningful for this committee is to focus on the policy packages where we have proposed and the governor has supported in her budget adds to our core budget. POP 101 is grants to local governments. As indicated in our earlier presentations, those go to coastal resiliency, and I'll talk a little bit about more how that money would be spent. POP 104 is also related to natural hazard mitigation planning, some overlap with a focus on coastal resiliency, but also working on flood, landslides, and fire-prone areas as well through the adoption of local hazard mitigation plans. And then POP 105 is staff funding for additional technical assistance in the area of coastal resiliency. I'm going to talk about POP 101 and 105 a little bit together because they're interwoven. And the way that we often do our work is to provide technical assistance to lead with, whether it's development of model code, planning charrettes, workshops, bringing experts in the field to local governments, and then our staff is there to help the local governments decide how to develop a work program, what elements are meaningful there to their community, what kind of code updates do they do. So in this area where we would be focusing our grant funds and this additional $250,000 appropriation for general fund grants in coastal resiliency would really be in two primary areas. The first is related to and is our highest priority at saving lives, and that goes to the Beat the Wave modeling, which you see an example of what we've been working on with the community of Seaside. What that entails is contracting with Dogami to do the Beat the Wave modeling to show how much time do you have in your particular community to evacuate, what are the evacuation routes you have now, and then to develop a evacuation facility improvement plan with that community to determine how to improve the ability for their residents to get to high ground safely. It's a real constraint in many of our communities. This also connects to our ocean and coastal program in the sense that part of that mapping and modeling also goes to highlighting areas within ports where damaging wave velocities are expected in terms of distant, more distant tsunamis, so that we are really protecting some of that critical infrastructure and economic development for those local governments. The second element, phase two, is really redevelopment visioning. So long-term planning for communities both inside and outside the tsunami zones. How do communities think about rebuilding their community after a tsunami has hit? If you're building off of the work that you've done with your evacuation route plan, are there some near-term improvements or changes to your transportation system plan, whether it's a pedestrian bridge that could be then part of a park system that is an attractant for your tourism, or is it a, you know, is it a vehicular bridge that really helps with other mobility in the near term, as well as making sure that residents can get out to safety? Where do we find those areas of near-term infrastructure improvements that have a real near-term cost benefit, as well as the longer term for future rebuilding and the evacuation routes? That would be a mix of both grant funding and staffing. POP 105 it adds $250,000, which would be one full-time staff planner to work directly with local communities, again, developing their evacuation improvement plans and developing a visioning process for future rebuilding efforts. How many communities we're able to do depends greatly upon the amount of grant funds that we have in this area. To give you a sense and context there, modeling for each community is about $13,000, so it's a relatively low cost proposition. It costs about $40,000 to develop evacuation facilities improvement plans and really bring that cost-benefit analysis into determining which projects should be prioritized by for a community. And that's, I mean, just to highlight, that's very important work, but that's just at the planning stage. Then local governments will need funding to actually implement and build out those plans. This is, I think, relevant just to the whole discussion, and I wanted the committee to have some grounding here, because you will hear about the concern from local governments that are not along the coast and how important our local technical assistance grant funds are for them and their planning endeavors. The stars represent communities that we have given grants to around the state in just the last biennium. It doesn't include our transportation growth management grants, because those wouldn't be affected by this redirection of grant funds. The counties that have the rectangle highlight around them are counties that we actually gave grants to. So, for example, in Harney County, we gave them a grant to do some Goal 5 updating for all of their natural resources after sage-grouse to make sure that they had a fully integrated plan.
Hold on just a second. Mm-hmm. So, but you're going to continue with the sage-grouse effort. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee, we will continue with the sage-grouse effort in our duties and obligations to maintain a development registry so that communities can implement the Goal 5 rule amendments and sage-grouse plan that the state adopted. But we will not be able to provide additional grant funding for other counties to do Goal 5 inventory updates if we are to prioritize our funding to coasts. We haven't had any requests for that as of yet, but... I can't say that there aren't any desires out there.
Thank you.
POP 104, I want to take in two parts if I can. And the first part being in the governor's recommended budget, there is approval of $100,000 that we would be getting from FEMA for risk map to continue work, like I talked about in Curry County, integrating all the different natural hazards that a community has into one planning process for a local government to then decide how to update their development regulations to mitigate and prevent damage to people and property in the event of a natural hazard. We also, after going through the governor's recommended budget process, were able to identify some additional federal funds and other funds that the department could receive and that we have adequate match for. So they're not in the governor's recommended budget. We hadn't identified yet those matching funds for us to be able to access it. We've worked with Legislative Fiscal Office. We've worked and received support from the Chief Financial Office and would be asking for the ability to increase our other fund and federal fund limitation such that we could accept those monies. I talked about POP 104 in conjunction, so we'll skip through there. We've talked a lot about policy here today, land use policy, and I really appreciated the conversation. So we wanted to make sure that the committee was aware that we do have one legislative proposal. It is tied to affordable housing, and it is a clarifying requirement that, communities that are smaller than 25,000, when they identify a housing need, a deficit in their community for a supply of, housing land, they too need to take steps to either rezone perhaps excess commercial or, land that they have in their property in their UGB for housing, or actually expand their urban growth boundary so that the needs of the residents and the growing population for communities are met. Obviously, this is an area that we want to be able to continue then to invest in with technical assistance and grant funding if we can with communities, but it's an area we feel is important with the real housing need across the state. When we did our research for House Bill 4079, as one of the slides that Director Rue talked about, the housing needs are both urban and rural. They are different. They have different causes. They probably have different solutions, but the needs are there. Renters around the state, about 76% of those people who make less than 80% of the area median income are cost constrained. They're spending more than 30% of their income on housing. That is a real drag on our economy in terms of the quality of life and opportunities in the state, and we certainly want to work to improve that. These are really just housekeeping items to point you to where we have the required documents in our budget. And I think, Jim, do you want me to wrap up? Do you want to wrap up?
Oh, please.
Okay. So I realize just a correction here. At the time that we began this presentation, the deficits or the pitfalls of pre-planning, in November, when I started putting these statistics together, we'd only had about 750 post-acknowledgement plan amendments, changes that local governments do. Well, we're now up above 950. So I think we will hit what happens for us about every biennium is about 1,100 plan amendments that we get that we review. We don't review all of them. We can't review all of them. We do review them for ones that we think may affect an area of real estate interest, housing affordability, economic development, public facilities planning. And then we also use them as a way for local governments to be able to request technical assistance from us. Where is our early assistance most able to make a successful local planning project? So obviously, with fewer planning staff, we will see a reduction. It's very difficult, I'm just going to say, to quantify that. Some of the phone calls that our local governments have take 15 minutes. Some take 15 hours, some takes 15 days, some takes 15 years. Not very many of those, but there are on occasion. And it's really that long-term commitment that I think that we want to have. So it's a difficult area for us to quantify. Obviously, number two, the prioritization for the coast, it's needed in terms of how to be able to prepare for, respond to, and recover from a catastrophic event. It has real repercussions for other communities in the state. We have in the last few years, I think, prided ourselves in being able to take on rulemaking projects to make minor adjustments to the land use planning program to work better. We will have less rulemaking capacity with a smaller budget. We'll still seek to have that be one of our priorities, and constant improvement is critical, but we will just simply have less capacity to carry those out. And one program that probably will see less activity is in our assistance with transfer development rights and Measure 49 claims. I think that brings us to a close of our presentation. So thank
I have you. To have. Oh, did you have a question?
Go I did.
Senator, go ahead.
Thank you. This is the budget committee, so I like all the presentation, but I kind of get wrapped up in numbers, like a couple of us do here, and so. You have all funds budget of $20 million. Okay, so I did a little math, and I divided that by two, cost per year is $10 million, times that by 75% for your labor cost, that's $7.5 million, and divided that by 53, the number of FTEs that you have, and I came out with a cost of $141,000 per FTE. So I don't know if that's right, but I would like to have what your average FTE cost is And I think, you know, if anybody else is listening, I'll be asking that for almost all the departments, because I think that's important for the public to know.
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Senator Girard. I would say in your 140,000, what you may want to take out of that is a little bit for supplies and services, but you're certainly in the ballpark. So the people that we hire are all graduate level planners. Everybody has at least a master's degree, some people PhDs and law degrees on top of that. We probably on average spend about $80,000 a year for those people, plus when you add on benefits, you're getting into that $120,000-$130,000 a year range, and then a little bit of supplies and services for travel and whatever else, and you're pretty close to the right number.
Okay, could you give me the right number?
Absolutely.
Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary, you indicated that there are a lot of cities that, for various reasons, are not completing their planning process. And was that 30% of the cities?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee, I was referring, that was, I think, to our first key performance measure around employment lands.
Yes.
And so only 30% of the cities in the state that are over 25,000 in size. So we're dealing with probably only about a few, I should get you the exact number, but I think it's somewhere under 30 cities that are that size. So it means about a third of those, 10 of those, have updated their economic opportunities analyses in the last 10 years. 20 of them then have not. So the reasons why those communities do not, I think, are multifaceted. Certainly one of them is the financial capacity for cities to do that planning themselves. So are they prioritizing, and do they have the funding to spend doing those economic opportunities analyses? A second one, and this is where I would love to have some of the information that Representative Helm asked if we had, is there are some cities who have fairly large urban growth boundaries and actually have enough land inside of their urban growth boundaries. And so prioritizing spending more money to answer that question again wouldn't necessarily be the most prudent source of their or expenditure of their funds. That is part supposition on us on our part, and part knowledge of working with local governments. But when they if they already have enough employment lands inside of their urban growth boundary, they're not going to seek to update that planning. And this is where our KPM is problematic, because it's an indirect measurement of what the department does in this field, and what control we have over those outcomes.
Follow up?
Sure.
Yesterday, you told us that, and it wasn't news to many of us in rural Oregon, that our economies are lagging in rural Oregon. Today, Jim tells us that if cities can't plan, the system doesn't work. And we have 20 sizable cities in the state of Oregon who have, for one reason, don't need to, don't want to, can't afford to conduct the planning associated with evaluating their economic opportunities. What does that mean for the economic drag on our state?
Representative or Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and members of the committee, long-range planning is critical to assuring that all Oregonians have access to the most productive and meaningful future that they can. We started off our presentation with a wheel that sort of connected land use planning as the hub to thinking about economic development, quality of life, housing choices, transportation capacity. In the near term, it looks like many areas of the state are beginning to recover better. Mark McMullen did a presentation early in the legislative session saying that the economic recovery was starting to even out around the state. That is good progress, and that is very, very welcome news. But for us, that doesn't mean that we don't stop pushing on articulating the need for grant funding, for technical assistance for our local governments, so that they may be fine now for the next 5 years. They may be okay even for the next 10. We want to assure that they have the roadmap for economic growth and opportunity for the next 20 years.
Any other?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just, I'm trying to figure out what it is that I'm, my level of frustration is that we have a tool here that isn't being utilized. I recognize fully that you can lead a horse to water. But maybe we need to make it a little more accessible to inhale that water. I don't know. I certainly am not sensing that there is an overabundance of economic opportunity in our state at this point. And to the extent that cities have opted out of that opportunity for whatever reason, I think we as a state, all of us collectively, have missed a huge opportunity here.
If I may, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, I think we all, excuse me, I think we all know that when communities don't have a strong job base, that we all end up paying for it, whether it's in health care costs, whether it's in other subsidies to people who have frankly been left behind. I don't know if you saw it today, but in this morning's Portland Tribune, Oregon today hit a new historic low in unemployment at 4.3%. We've never been there before. So parts of this state are doing extraordinarily well, and other parts of the state are really in trouble. And so what one of the things that we're trying to do, whether it's with data sharing, whether it's with technology sharing, is to try to use the infrastructure that we have, mostly the management and government infrastructure that we have, to get some help to struggling communities. And I'm thinking particularly of the regional solutions team. It's actually neighboring, but it goes partly into your district. Mark Ellsworth's team. Those guys are out every single day with the cities in that Northwest district, trying to come up with job and employment development opportunities and schemes and supporting. And so, as you know very well, there's work going on in Toledo and Garibaldi and Rainier, trying to get something going. And I just think that's the job that's ahead of us.
Mr. Chairman, if I might change the subject in another question.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for the work that you do, by the way, in economic development. It's truly, truly appreciated, and it does have a huge impact. And it does mean a lot to our communities. I'm just seeing there's some folks that are cut out of the herd for whatever reason at this point. Carrie talked about beating the wave. And I sometimes worry that we plan and plan and plan and plan maybe to make ourselves feel good. But if we go to a number of our coastal communities, I'm left wondering when the big shake comes, presuming that we have a road and bridge infrastructure left after the shake, does that transportation infrastructure, and I realize you're not ODOT, but does that transportation infrastructure reasonably have the carrying capacity to deliver everybody to the same high spot at the same time?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, and members of the committee, I would say That is the purpose of the planning, is to be able to identify what the capacity is. We do through Regional Solutions also, I mean, to call that out again, is a great forum in which we really try to make sure we are making, that ODOT shares our assessments of where investments should be made, that their technical expertise is there. It is plans on the shelf that show us how we can get there are not going to achieve resilient communities. There does need to be a pipeline, a facilitation by state and local government to invest in those actual physical improvements that implement the plans. And that is an area that is outside of our direct wheelhouse, but is an area that is meaningful for us to evaluate when we say, what's the efficacy of producing these plans? We think that there are many areas in which doing the beat the wave modeling, showing how fast, how long a community has to get out, prioritizing through cost-benefit analysis, what are those routes that are most sustainable and most efficacious to build from an economic perspective, is the right prioritization for communities, albeit a different difficult conversation.
And
go ahead.
I would just add that sometimes I feel like we don't even cover the very basics. We try and build bridges to sustain a major shake, and yet we know that everyone's running to high ground, and when you get up there, there's either got to be one humongous parking lot or a way for me and 10,000 other people to drive the car over the cliff so that the people behind us can get up too, and I just don't see it happening. I'm sorry. Anyways.
I understand. Did you have something as well?
I'm not.
No. Okay. A couple of quick things for me. I am curious, and this is I'm pleased to see that we're looking at how we're going to deal with the resiliency along the coast. But what's our time frame on getting that? How long will it take for us to come up with to say, okay, we've done most of this work, and then what are the expectations for future grants to those places that we have pulled out of?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, we're looking at about 5 years to cover the coastal communities with the very basic planning. Obviously, $1.5 million doesn't go very far, but what we've gotten pretty good at is working with sister agencies, whether it's ODOT or Business Oregon or others, to try to get multipliers off of the little bit of money that we can give. So we have targeted with the money that we have, that we can probably do, if the universe is roughly 30 cities in the coastal zone, we can get a reasonably good job done of 5 or 6 of those a year, and we are looking at a 5-year project to make sure that they're all at a base level.
The second part of that question is in terms of the expectations of those other places that we're basically pulled out of. Are we saying anything to them to say, this is what we're going to do, and we are looking at the 5-year plan?
Yes, we have. And so tomorrow, I expect that you will hear League of Cities and Association of Oregon Counties come in and talk to you about the fact that we simply cannot afford to pull that planning money away from all of the other 211, whatever 241 minus 30 is. And so that is the conversation we need to have. That is now, frankly, in your lap. You're very welcome. Because the need is broad, the resources are few.
Shall we move on? Because that's a perfect line to go to the next. The need is. Oh yes, Representative Esquivel.
Does not ODOT have some sort of a plan in place for their infrastructure in case of a catastrophic event?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, the short answer is yes. We went through, and I know I'm taking Kathy's time here, so I'll make this really quick. We went through a planning exercise last summer called Cascadia Rising. And in that exercise, Highway 18 was the only highway to the coast that survived. Every other bridge from the valley failed, and most of the north-south bridges failed. Matt Garrett has taken this challenge very seriously, very personally, and they are, as far as I know, putting together a strategy to at least armor those bridges going in a north-south direction. How we get relief supplies to those stranded coastal communities is dependent, obviously, on severity, but it's also going to be a time issue. And part of this exercise was mobilizing the fleet from San Diego to come up here and to pull into Newport and other serviceable bays and harbors to begin to deliver, because we know we're not going to get it there by roadway.
Thank you. Kathy, if you would.
Yes. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, I have just a couple of things the agency's done. I'm Kathy Conley with the Chief Financial Office, and the agency's done a great job of talking about their budget, so I just have a couple of things to put on the record. This agency has a number of emerging issues, but certainly the focus of the governor's budget has been the planning for resilience and the state's focus on coastal resilience, and Director Rue's description of Cascadia Rising tells you a lot about why that focus is there. This is their short expenditure history. The agency's done a good job. And the agency showed you a much longer history of their grant expenditures. But even in the last 10 years, the agency had a high in 2009-11 of 2.1 in general fund grants. And that dipped during the recession, and we are still not back there. The governor's budget's proposed level is about 1.75. Don't want to contradict Director Rue, but I think this graphically demonstrates what is going on with the governor's budget as compared to the current biennium. The director, when he answered your question about how much is spent on personnel and staff, is describing the agency he has now. This is the governor's budget for this agency. 66% is spent on personal services. Services and supplies is another 20%, but this agency, certainly a chunk of that supports their staff, but they have over $750,000 devoted to legal costs in this agency. Their special payments, as I said, about 1.75 are their general fund. The balance of their special payments is either other funds or primarily federal funds that are grants going out to the communities. So, this is a different budget. This agency is facing significant cuts, and the cuts are in their staffing. So the governor is asking them to put more money out into the communities and work with less staff to do that. The agency is funded primarily with general fund. They do have those federal grants, but those are generally directed very, very specifically to certain things. With the FEMA, it's hazard planning, natural hazard planning, and with the NOAA grants, it is coastal planning. And then their other funds are really the transportation planning. Agency's done a great job of describing their investments. I just want to put on the record that the governor does support their request to add other fund and federal fund limitation to POP 104. We've had some discussions on that, and we are on board with that. And then finally, we also support the requested changes in the KPMs. They make sense. We've worked on those for more than a biennium. And with that, I am done, unless I can answer any questions.
Are there any more questions? No? We're just about on time here. Yes. Were you going to say something else?
Senator Girard, when you ask, because I will spread the word to the other analysts and agencies about the cost of FTE, are you asking for cost of FTE in 15-17, the current biennium, 17-19, the new one, or both?
Actually, 17, 19 probably would be more what I'd be looking at. But as you know, as a Republican, we're looking at the overall cost for government, period. And so, you know, the cost that we're paying per FTE, I think, is extremely relevant. And, well, actually, I would like both because I want to see the change, because in their benefit packages, that's where a lot of the change is occurring. And, you know, I think that that's something the public needs to deal with. So I'm just one of those that think we have $1.5 billion more dollars than we've ever had, and we're not making cuts, but that's me.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. So building on what Senator Girard brought up, when you report back on those costs, of course you'll know what the different what's comprised in those benefits, meaning the health care, PERS contribution, et cetera. How difficult would it be for you to show us that breakdown a little bit so we can differentiate? And this agency is a little bit different because the FDE do cost more in the sense of that the higher degree level, et cetera. So I would think. But
Senator, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Senator Taylor, what we can bring back, so I think the agency, what we can bring back on things like PERS percentages and, you know, what's the average percentage? We have averages that we can provide you with that say across state government, this is the average. Okay. From agency to agency, it depends, and it depends at a point in time because it's such a personal thing. But we can certainly bring back those statewide averages for those and provide those to the committee.
Follow up?
Yes.
I just mean showing what the current is and what's in the budget is really not – that's just for this, I think, that we – just overall, because we're having a conversation, Chair Frederick, about you know, budgets, and you know, there's going to be some cuts that are going to be made. I just think that all of us need to be mindful of where those costs lie, and when we make decisions about cuts and approving budgets.
I think that's very true. I think the key for me is not just the cost, but the effectiveness. What we're doing, and whether it's working or not. And who it's working for. So as we take a look at that, that's going to be the key for me, is looking at those issues. And having said that, I think it is time for us to close this hearing on Senate Bill 5527, and we'll close the meeting, the hearing itself. This will adjourn until tomorrow.